to Ferdinand de Saussure, how general linguistics lost its rudimentary quality of individual expression. A philosopher with an encompassing fear of the future named Gans once wrote, "The individual self necessarily finds itself to be late with respect to the apparently already formed community of others, which possess the threat of a violent expulsion." Causality, generality, and rationality, behold, three of the most desirable ways to create the objects of science. As soon as the origins are untraceable and cannot be deduced or found, linguistic usually becomes the dominant mode of enterprise. Who dares to engage in ontology these days? All ontology seems to be ontology of collective memory, and this is an inevitable result of linguistics itself. As it seems also, the growth of Western philosophy too has contributed to this external concentration of collective traces. At the root of it all, or so it seems, there is an existential hostile relation of individual bodies being threatened by pre-existing communities, like Gans believes, through the mere fact of their birth. Causality implies evolutionism, generality allows for universality, and rationality ensures structuralism. Causality or causalities are the remainders of the quest of origin. Evolutionism as well, as that it entails the true functionalistic approach towards the problem of origin, as does structuralism, which creates or at least suggests a sort of stability. The quest for the origin was never fully abandoned. It has returned time and again into major disguises. One is depicted through the struggle surrounding the arbitrary nature of the sign, a necessity to overcome the idea of an origin for the sake of etymology and grammar. The second disguise, contrary to the first, is more openly practiced. This disguise concerns theories which are mainly presented as developmental civilization theories. No longer does the topic seek origins as historical events, but rather focuses on the tension between the event and development. These theories, like for instance the work of Girard and Gans, view invent as an originary event. This originary event supposedly constructs a major element of human culture, designed to deal with the requirements forthcoming the violent nature of individuals. In this sense, the origin of language is a direct result of the violent nature of individuals, who seem to need a sort of culturally shared experience which prevents them from killing each other. Civilization theories indeed seem to be a historical byline in modernism. They can nevertheless be quite dangerous in their practical implications. Civilization theories partly claim universality through a moral imperative, but maybe more important because they suggest a violent relation between individuals a priori. On the surface, mere application of the term civilization seems to dispose of a notion which considers individuals as isolated tropes, to use an impossible metaphor. But underlying this action, they superioriize the idea of an existing collective Gnosticism, which needs to restrain the supposedly violent nature of individuals. Devious or not, the core element of this type of theory comes from attempts to overcome questions on the origin of language. And these attempts are marked by the creation of modern general linguistics. Ferdinand de Saussure has been one of the most influential scientists who constructed the foundations of modern general linguistics in Europe. Much of his theory is constituted around William Dwight Whitney's concept of the arbitrary nature of the sign. His earlier work was published in Leipzig in 1878, and consists of a study of comparative grammar, Mémoire sur le système primitif des vogelles dans les langues indo-européennes. It has been concluded by Lepsky, among others, that the essential character of this study would now be called structuralistic, that is, taking into account the whole system, he, de Saussure, postulates elements of an abstract character which are defined on the basis of their structural function, rather than their phonetic shape. However, the structuralistic nature of de Saussure's earlier work is usually not considered as important compared to his synchronic approach towards language. I feel that the connection between structuralism and general linguistics cannot be denied. In his later years, around 1894, letters which de Saussure wrote to his contemporary Migette suggest that de Saussure was disappointed by linguistics. Except for his later dissertation, which was regarded a mere technical piece, he seems to have published little. De Saussure's legacy furthermore consists of one book which has been composed by his former students on his teachings in general linguistics. He did not have the intention of publishing this course. It was first published in 1915 after de Saussure died in 1913. And the irony of the composition is that it has been subjected to the same mechanism that befell the faith of linguistics. It has been composed, transforming oral speech into written texts, which is not of the author himself. The composers, Charles Bailey and Albert Schoenhaie, explain about this process of composing. We first had to weed out variations and irregularities characteristic of oral delivery, then to fit the thought into its natural framework and present each part of it in the order intended by the author, even when his intention, not always apparent, had to be surmised. I have always found great difficulty in reflecting on such composed texts. First of all, the author's oral delivery usually is the result, and especially in this case, of interactions with his students. And he might not say exactly what he believes to be for reasons of clarifying concepts. The results of his delivery might be more absolute than his intention is. Secondly, as de Saussure's oral delivery has been conceptualized in writing, according to a process in which several people strive towards a consensus, this, too, makes the origin of the text rather questionable where his intentions are concerned. Thirdly, we can never know what de Saussure would have written himself. He might have had an entirely different outlook in composing a book. Therefore, with the authors of courses in linguistics, I bear in mind that my critique does not apply to de Saussure himself, but rather to his followers, and there are plenty of those. Last but not least, de Saussure's disappointment with linguistics makes me wonder how many of his concepts he intended to serve the creation of a general linguistics. His personal manuscript, as well as from his letters to Meyer, suggested that de Saussure was more interested in a theory of anagrams and poetry, which, according to Roland Barthes, suggests an escape from rationality of linguistics rather than a general construction of a theory of language. It is, however, not my intention to review the entire realm of general linguistics. In this letter, I will deal with those elements of it about which I feel have been of inevitable dominance over the role of individual body perception and expression within linguistics. Where possible, I have tried to limit myself to the implications of the concepts concerning origin, as I found they play a constitutive role in the supposed objectivity of grammar, the construction of consensus, the difference between man and animal, the reflection on previous philosophers like Herder and Rousseau, the dominance of psychological concepts, and, last but not least, the construction of pluralifying groups or classification at the expense of existential relations between individual and conceptual communalis. I do not wish to use the term community here, because it all takes place within linguistics and therefore cannot be other than conceptual. Furthermore, although I do not agree with the idea of traceable origins, I do agree with the concept developed by Gans, for instance, that starts from an attempt for originary dialogue and entails that, according to him, we must provide not a rewriting of history itself, but a basis for dialogue between different moments of history, a dialogue mediated by our common human experience of origin. But contrary to Gans, I believe that viewing ideas on the origin of language is best suited to create a historical dialogue. Not a final one, but one which shows the endless creation of individual sparks of life through time, which possesses a critique not so much of the past, but of the present, and attempts to create the ethics and non-ethics for the future of any given community. Such moments can never, however, constitute a universal morality, and God help us if it does. If we view the earlier theories, according to Edward Sapir, the attempts to unravel the origin of language are hardly more than exercises of speculative imagination. The quest has been abandoned for basically two reasons. In the first place, there are no real primitive languages in the present. Neither does archaeology, and never will, have the tools to study languages of the past. Secondly, if there is an origin to language, linguistics alone could not solve the problem, because it would at least take a genesis of symbolic development regarding the specialization of the larynx to shed any light on the matter. Basically, we are left with a legacy of onomatopoeic and interjectual theories. Though the quest for origin of language itself has been abandoned, the early theories on onomatopoeic and interjection, however, did force linguistic theory into an irreversible direction. The basic theories created a difference between the expressive and the referential forces of language for all eternity. The difference between expression and reverence in linguistics, at least, has been the birthmark of the topic on the individual expression in the here and now versus the linguistic community in the past and former. How onomatopoeia and interjections could take on such a role is not surprising, as de Saussure had already noted that both of these vocal expressions seem to refute the arbitrary nature of the sign at first sight. But in comparison between languages, they are still bound by a limited number of rather arbitrary possibilities. Whether or not the expressive and the referential force of language constitute a genuine difference is part and parcel of speculation too. Whether or not a cry of pain establishes a linguistic expression meant for communication seems to matter very little in theory. As I explained to Karl Popper, the general idea of children not having a self as a result of their incapacity to speak the language of their elders is basically ludicrous as well as dangerous. In linguistics, however, many scientists do not seem to be aware that the theories concerning the origin of language have constructed to such a large extent the discipline of linguistics itself. It has, as many disciplines in social sciences, the tendency to escape its own fundamental premises by posing them off as arbitrary. This arbitrariness already started with the definition of the nature of language. As a matter of great interest, one needs only to compare Edward Sapir's remarks with the remarks of Ferdinand de Saussure on the matter of phonetics. Sapir states, for instance, that language does not seem to depend upon the use of articulated sound, but nevertheless, the actual history of man and the wealth of anthropological evidence indicates with overwhelming certainty that the phonetic language takes precedence over all other kinds of communicative symbolism, all of which are, by comparison, either substitutive, like writing, or excessively supplementary, like gesture accompanying speech. And Ferdinand de Saussure, inspired by Whitney, believes that the use of vocal apparatus is more or less arbitrary, that is to say, of secondary importance. Language is a convention, and the nature of the sign that is agreed upon does not matter. The question of the vocal apparatus obviously takes a secondary place in the problem of speech. This contradiction at least evokes the question on what makes the link between phonetic apparatus and linguistic utterance a matter of arbitrariness, or a matter of convenience. It might be that some origins have been abandoned for the sake of creating other origins. In the case of general linguistic, it might well be for the sake of describing a language, not as an utterance of meaning by speech, but as a system of meaning by convention. Though the phonetic quality of speech does not seem to matter for general linguistics, it contains at the same time the mystery between the concept and the sound. In effect, it contains the key to arbitrariness of the sign. Benviste, the scientist, considered this point to be a main critique on the arbitrary nature of the sign in general linguistics, as he believed that non-verbal forms of communication do not necessarily have a structure equivalent to that of the spoken language, or are in equivalent ways expressive. He considered quite bluntly that to say that the linguistic sign is arbitrary because the same animal is called sea buff in one country and sea ox elsewhere is like saying that the notion of mourning is arbitrary because its symbol in Europe is black and it is white in China. Arbitrary, yes, but only to the impassive gaze of Sirius, or for someone who is content to observe from the outside the relation established between an objective reality and a form of human behavior, and who is thus condemned to find contingency alone. This, in itself, also imposes the question if the structuralistic comparisons in terms of binary opposition, such as applied by Leach on culture, or the study of kinesics, like that of Birdwistle and his fellow scholars, such as applied on the body, do not in fact float on the rather leak rowboat of arbitrariness. But why then is this arbitrary nature of the sign so persistent? It could well be that because of the link, the missing link of bodily presence in grammar, linguists have to pursue the connection between the sound and concept. The result has been a dominant psychologizing idea of language, as the sound escapes the thing it names, and the concept therefore has to obtain a disembodied quality in order to be objectified. It is the same old separation of body and mind which dominates Western philosophy that dominates general linguistics. In fact, it entails even more. General linguistics implies hierarchy. It implies a moralism of a certain nature, which poses itself off as a universal, and last but not least, it implies that individuals have less of a capacity for language, less of a world of perception and expression than language allows for in general. The most frightening aspect about this notion of language is that its disguise can be presented as a rational scientific discipline of grammar, and At the same time, it implicates, hidden behind the signified, a giant model for universal moralism. But what of the original individual body? How does the constructed grammar relate to the relentless existing of individual bodies? As Roland Barthes could not find himself within the generality of language and could not speak the same language simply because he did not have the same body, it is easy to assume that individual bodies at least exceed the social texture of language. It would not be right to talk of context anymore, as the Western philosophical tradition is one of text, and the context merely refers to the presence of individual bodies, who are never actually there in the text, as they are bound by the context of opportunity, the context of acting. The lack of access into this context of opportunity has indeed led to theories concerning the psychological or conceptual conveyance of signs. Circuiting, too, has become an integral part of these theories of conveyance, and it could be called odd to say at least that Ferdinand de Saussure exemplifies that in order to separate from the whole of speech the part that belongs to language. We must examine the individual act from which the speaking circuit can be reconstructed. The act requires a presence, at least of two persons, that is a minimum number to complete the circuit. This in itself shows that the part which belongs to language must be the result of a minor majority of speakers. The individual act of speaking is never really the topic of investigation, as circuiting itself already implies consensus. Such a consensus seems to bypass the problem of origin, but at the same time it restores the necessity of the scientific rationale, which is, after all, cause and effect. Fancying circuiting simply means cause and effect as a repetition in time, and, in this sense, causality, in fact, imposes restriction on origins, as well as change. However, in spite of the restriction posed on origins by causality, origins are important. They may, however, not be important for the reconstruction of social history, which does most of its reconstructing for the sake of continuity. No. In fact, the quest for origins tells us more about the expectations concerning the future than it does about the past. This is not a revolutionary idea. It was launched, among others, by Umberto Eco, who found rather strange similarities between the discourse on dark Middle Ages and the discourse of science fiction, the comic strip as well as the novels. In this rather prophetic context, I view the origin of linguistics as well as the quest for the origin of language. First of all, because I do not believe signs are arbitrary, in spite of the fact that their original objects cannot be measured linguistically. And second of all, because I feel that the arbitrariness of the sign is a very clever human device, which has developed in the high times of modernism and has very little to do with the untraceable origins. I might add that the arbitrary nature of the sign is more linked to the concept of mathematics than it is linked to the existence of social communication, though it nevertheless brings about an algebraic formula for the relation between individuals and society. Next to all this, I cannot help but feel remotely distrustful about the fact that the arbitrary nature of the sign, its supposed exchangeability, reminds me persistently of the modern industrial and monetary exchange system of the late 19th and early 20th century. Rousseau concluded in his essay on the origin of language that the reduction of language to the old monotonous rational message has led to the contrary of what communication is about. There's no need for people to communicate anymore if the message is the same everywhere, and he believed societies have assumed the last form, Nothing can be changed in them any more except with cannons or cash. And since there is nothing left to say to people but give money, it is said with posters on street corners or with soldiers in their homes, for which it is not necessary to assemble people. On the contrary, the subjects must be kept dispersed. That is the first maxim of modern politics. And therefore, in the midst of all prophecy, dear Ferdinand,